So according to the schedule, we've got 10 people that are going to go today. Somehow that seems unrealistic to me. But I would like to go forward in 15-minute chunks. And if some go over till tomorrow, that may just be how it has to be. I was also asked very intelligently what I expected to get from you at the end of the semester. I want from each of you a link, an email with a link in it to whatever you have done. And if you'd be willing to do this, a 5-page double space critique of another project in the class, so that when I see a project from any one of you, I also see another's critique of it. And in a sense, get the benefit of both. The critique I'm looking for will in some measure assess the state, the argument that's being made, and assess the empathy with which it's being made. And offer critique about the strategy of projection. Critique and suggestion. This is meant to be utterly constructive criticism. All right, who's up first today? You're on.
So my project is, my project is basically my look at the migration of a Windows user, an advanced Windows user, I guess in the common parlance would be a power user, to Linux, and an analysis of the arguments that the Windows users that I personally know and that I've read about online have put forward as to why they're still on the platform that they're on. So basically, at a very high level, you're looking at mainly two things. One of them is cost, and the other is compatibility. And to some degree, there is an overlap. But I think that these are two pretty useful categories of arguments that a lot of power users make when they're justifying not moving to Linux. So as far as the compatibility goes, you can break that down into hardware compatibility, and you can break it down into software compatibility. So as far as the hardware goes, there's a further breakdown there, which is that as far as I've seen, it's old hardware and new hardware. So as far as old hardware goes, I think it's fairly clear that Linux, on the whole, is superior in terms of its support, especially given the recent XP to Vista changeover, and you know a fair amount of XP compatible hardware has sort of been lost in the mix under Vista, and so that's really been one place where Linux has been shining. But then you flip over to new hardware, and it's more or less generally accepted, especially with video cards and wireless network cards, that Linux support has some way to go. And part of this is due to the fact that vendors don't tend to be, as manufacturers don't tend to be as open with their specs, and so what you find is that Linux drivers tend to lag Windows drivers by a non-trivial amount of time, and feature sets don't always aren't always complete on a particular set of Linux drivers. So, you know, you'll have the basic video acceleration on the graphics card, but you may not have, you know, TV out. So, you know, that's sort of an even keel in terms of how Vista compares to, and Windows generally compares to Linux generally on the hardware side. As far as software goes, what I've seen is a further breakdown into game compatibility and just general productivity or general application compatibility. And on Linux, I think it's difficult to argue that the gaming is anywhere near the quality of the experience on Windows. There is one particular application compatibility layer called Wine, which provides some support. And I think that, you know, this argument can also be made for general application compatibility. So basically what it lets you do is run Windows software on Linux. And it doesn't create a virtual machine. It's not an emulator. It's just a sort of on-the-fly translator for Windows software. And there is a compatibility database online. So you can go ex ante and check to see if a particular program is compatible, how well it runs on various flavors of Linux, assuming that people have, you know, tried that particular combination, submitted it online. So that's, you know, it's a bit of a crapshoot, but for most productivity software, it's not really much of a problem. But in my experience, the better way to go about on Linux when you're looking for software to achieve a particular task is not to look at the compatibility of a particular bit of Windows software with Linux, but rather to find a piece of Linux software that does what you want natively. And herein is where I have found, talking to you know, Windows power users, here is sort of where I find a philosophical difference that really needs to be bridged in order for them to really see any major benefits to coming to Linux, and that is the ability to make choices. For any particular task that you want to achieve, there are, you know, sometimes three, sometimes four, for popular types of utilities, there can be up to a dozen different open source projects that all produce different programs that can do what you want. But you have to take the initiative, essentially. If you want to be a serious Linux user and really make use of the platform, you have to take the initiative to go out and acquire the information, talk to people who are knowledgeable, and ultimately make a choice. And when I was talking to some of my Windows friends recently, that really hit home for me when they were talking about, you know, choosing a distribution, you know, where do you start? What distribution do you choose? What subflavor? You know, where do you even go just to download the ISO of the install disk? Even before that, you know, do you choose to have it mailed to you? Do you choose to torrent it? Do you download it straight from a mirror? Which mirror do you choose? One of the recurring themes I saw was choice. And without trying to cast aspersions, a lot of the Windows users I talk to don't really seem to like choice. They don't like making decisions. They don't like having a large field of you know, choices that they may or may not have good information about. And so that really seems to scare them off. So I think if any arguments are to be made, you know, it would either have to be an argument in favor of learning about, you know, whatever it is that you need to do on your computer and being able to make rational, informed choices, or you would just somehow have to convince them that, you know, they're just philosophically wrong and that.
All right, let's see if we can just cut it there.
Sure.
How did you feel?
There were times where I felt frustrated, and it was because, you know, I used to be in their shoes, and
no, how did you feel talking to us
about this?
Yeah.
Somewhat nervous. I guess I feel biased about it, and to some degree I suppose that's difficult to avoid given that I'm making an argument in favor of a particular position. But I made my own decision on this particular topic some time ago, and I didn't choose it based on any sort of zealotry, but more based out of my own self-interest. So there's that self-disclosure there. Is there anything else that you're trying to get at?
This experience of standing in front of an audience and making an argument is, it's got a rhetorical quality to it. And in some sense, there's a challenge to embrace it. So, from my point of view, as a member of an audience experiencing the presentation coming this way, what I'm looking for is, well, what am I looking for? I'm looking for something that's interesting. I'm looking for character. I'm looking for narrative. I'm looking for, I don't know, something quirky. I'm looking for honesty. And I'm looking for engagement. And so it's just it's a frame of mind that if you can turn around and try and engage it, it makes the experience of doing what you're trying to do, actually the doing of it, more fun. It's like you start to feel like you're playing it rather than it's playing you. But your argument is, well, I also wasn't really feeling like I was being persuaded by what you were saying. It was, I think at the point that I loved that you made was about choice. Some people like a lot of choice and they go for it. They're like, they become connoisseurs, they become masters of the space. Others like to have it be just as quick and easy as possible and do what they want to do.
So in presenting my argument, do you think it would be effective to say, instead of just list a number of generally submitted arguments and rebuttals, to perhaps present the user with a series of questions, and then based on those questions, I hesitate to say customized answers, but something along that line.
I was thinking more along the lines of introducing yourself. But as it's your narrative, it's actually interesting. And you're into being a Linux user for reasons that are good and sufficient to yourself. And somehow, if you were to reify those reasons in a narrative that got it across to me, I might somehow catch your excitement.
Well, I can start right now, if you would like.
I think we have to go on.
Interest of time, yeah. Okay.
But yeah, that's where I was going. So who's up next? You got enough control?
I think the projector needs to be warmed up, right?
Yeah, it might.
How do I turn it on?
Hit the laptop. And then we have to plug a laptop into it.
Okay. Yeah, I can go. I just have to put my laptop in.
Okay. So how are we going to figure out who's going to critique who so that we make sure we go around the circle?
I
volunteer or you can assign it.
Is there some equitable and rational way of...
Do it alphabetically. Do it by sense. The person that doesn't belong in the list.
That works for me.
Is there a copy of the class list anywhere?
Yeah.
Hmm?
Is there a copy of the class list so we can find out?
Andrew, have you got a copy of the class list?
Not exactly. I only have the one that's published on my HLS, which doesn't include a couple of people in here.
But I guess I could get one from the registrar.
All right.
Go when ready.
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier in class when we were going over ideas, my concept was to try to share some kind of unorthodox ideas or maybe unpopular ideas that I think would improve the law school experience. You know, as a 3L, I've looked back on law school and I feel like I miss a lot of opportunities to really, like, you know, learn how to think differently and all these things I was told I would get from law school. And I think that there's a lot of specific things that kept me from gaining a lot of knowledge from my law school experience, and I feel like I'll leave pretty much with the same skills I entered with. So, first thing I did was I created a blog to try to share my ideas by, you know, creating these blog entries. So, I started out with just like a little background on myself and what led me to reflect on law school and want to share my ideas on improving it. And then in conjunction with my blog, I started a Facebook group called Fixing Law School. And what I did is posted all my blog entries on there and also put some discussion topics on there to try to spark some interest in the topic. So on the blog, the first thing I tackled is kind of like the most obvious that's been discussed at length, but I thought maybe I could throw in a little bit, you know, some original take on the topic, which is that I think that though I love playing on the computer in class, the biggest thing that prevents people from learning in law school is the laptop. And I kind of wrote a pretty long post about all the different reasons I think laptops are bad. And I think the basic idea is that, you know, law schools, they rushed to add laptops when the technology boom of the late 90s came along. Everyone wanted to have a technology-enhanced classroom. But in law school, it doesn't really help. And I thought it was interesting that someone commented on that on my Facebook group. And I was excited that I have about 30 members, but even some people who I didn't invite, like some people from the 2L class who I guess found out about it, and even someone from UChicago commented. So this lady, Morgan Ricketts, said, "Laptops serve no function except to make bad classes bearable." So I thought that was, you know, kind of cool that someone actually looked at my blog and thought about it. The other suggestion, my second one, was that I think that maybe we should abolish the sections, 1L sections. And I mainly came up with that idea because though I like my section, I think it kind of splits apart the incoming class. And a lot of times, you don't feel very connected with students outside of your section. And as a 2L or 3L, you're often meeting people for the first time. You might be missing out on a great collaborator for a written piece or get some point of view that you missed. And I think it would be a more cohesive class if we just got rid of the sections and randomized the 1L classes so you had a mix in each class. And the last major one that I tackled was improving legal writing courses. And my suggestions were that legal writing courses should be given with more credit so that people take them seriously. They should be graded, and that perhaps they should include corporate drafting exercises and not just litigation, so that the people who don't think they'll be litigators are more engaged in class. And law students in general, they're so competitive. If there was a grade associated with it and it had the same credit as the other 1L classes, they take it more seriously. And legal writing is probably the one thing that will really help you in a real job at a firm or in government or even at a nonprofit. So I got that stuff out there, and I was excited to see that, at least on the Facebook group, there were some reactions. And I got some kind of silly ones, like saying that people don't exercise enough in law school, or someone said they spent 20 minutes reading my blog in class on their laptop. But just yesterday, someone, I don't know how he or she found the Facebook page. But they argued that the Socratic method is, you know, counterproductive, and that we should have more active learning in class. You know, you should have team-based exercises, and that the teacher shouldn't hide the ball, because, you know, semester-long classes in law school can be covered by Barbary in, you know, a morning. So maybe we're wasting our time. So I thought that was interesting. My future goals with this is, you know, try to get as many people as possible to join the group. Anyone in this class I'm friends with, I invited. The rest of you can just search for Fixing Law School. It's completely open. And I posted some of the stuff from my wall into the blog so that, you know, anybody who's possibly reading the blog out there would be able to see that if they're not on the Facebook group. You can see here I posted the comment from the person at University of Chicago. And I'd hope to maybe condense some of these ideas into an article and get it published somewhere, maybe online or maybe in, you know, the Record or something like that, or something similar. And I'd just like to keep working on it and getting the word out and getting interesting ideas from other people if anyone wants to submit anything, like some of the ideas I've gotten. But yeah, that's about it. Is there any questions?
Is it all one word for the Facebook group? Or is it
just Fixing?
For it, it's not coming up.
It looks like there's a space in there. Fixing Law School. Maybe there's not a space in there. Try Fixing Law School. Huh, that's weird. But you can also just...
No, come on, we've got to find it on Facebook.
I don't know. How do I find out? Let me look at that. Let me edit it.
Just go to his profile.
It's not in there.
It kind of looks like there's not a space between Fixing and Law. I don't know if I can change that. It's kind of strange.
No, there is.
Yeah, there's the group, so I think it's an open group, but I'll email it out to the class once I figure out how to link to it directly. Oh, it's open group on Harvard Network. It keeps switching back from open to the world to open to Harvard every day. I don't really know why.
Does anybody know why?
It's really strange. I set it as open from the beginning. So if anyone knows why that happens, let me know. Did you have a question?
Not a question, a suggestion. I guess a question. So I guess, is the purpose of it to, so you're saying that you came into the school and then you left, you feel like you're leaving without having learned anything. So is it to make sure that people know the law better, or do you feel, what skill do you think, what is the goal of when you change the curriculum, is the goal to make sure that people know the law better, or that they can apply their skills better, or do you think it should be more like hands-on stuff?
I think it's a combination of both. For one thing, you know, I'm almost done with law school, but some of it is kind of altruistic, hoping that, you know, future law students will have a better experience than I did. Though I enjoyed law school, I don't know if I learned what I came in intending to. And also, I think that the law, as an evolving, you know, concept, if everyone's playing on their laptops all the time and not listening in class, they're not likely to come up with new legal theories or interesting creative takes, and there'll be a lot of, what's the word? Nothing will change in law school pedagogy.
I'm sorry, but, because actually my project is kind of, like, opposed to yours in a direct way, almost, because I advocate that we should allow laptops in school at all times. Have you considered that some of your ideas that are going to fix law school are going to completely make it inaccessible for other people?
Well, you know, I remember your comment in class, and in my post on banning laptops, I mentioned that there should be exceptions in the policy for people who have any kind of disability that requires the use of laptops. So, and there would be like official note takers also. I mean, I just kind of threw it out there, but I said there should be a nuanced policy. It shouldn't just be like a bright line rule.
Well, I think that's good that you would think to have an exception. I think that exceptions are kind of intrinsically bad in a way, because this is actually, I wrote about this in my project, because it kind of makes the people with a disability kind of stand out, and then a lot of times there's resentment. Oh, why should, you know, she be able to use a laptop, or he be able to use a laptop when I can't? That's not fair. He has or she has an advantage that I don't have. And it kind of,
well, I mean, I think that's a possibility, but I mean, I'm in a lot of, I'm in several, I'm in a Kennedy School class where there's a deaf student, and so she gets all the lectures typed out, like word for word. And I don't know if anyone in the class ever felt any resentment, even though we have to take our own notes. But I think it's just something that they, you know, the policymakers at a school would have to figure out. If they were going to ban all laptops, maybe they would just have an official note set from a note taker and not allow anyone to use the computer. But it's just a suggestion. I also suggested like a half step, which is just turning off internet access in the rooms, because it's the internet on the laptop that's the main distraction, though I've seen people, you know, watching The Simpsons on there too. So, you know, I think there could be like a middle ground that would work out for everyone.
So I just want to throw some more weight behind her argument. It basically, I mean, here's my disability. I write about 5 times slower than I type. Is that a real disability? I'm not actually disabled, right? I just write slowly, like many people who have been typing for the last 10 years continuously. I almost never have occasion to actually use a pencil. So, in order to take any kind of notes, whether I'm taking a transcription, like many, you know, people take notes like that, or whether I'm, you know, if there's an official note service, I still might want to jot down like the important points or something, or my take on it. You know, maybe I think of something from something else that I read for another class, and I want to record that somehow. I mean, while certainly I could be jotting it on scraps of paper, which I will then proceed to lose, I think it's a lot better to use a computer. And about cutting off internet access, that's going to become extremely impractical in a number of years, maybe 3 or 4 years, because the Wi-Fi blanket is getting increasingly huge. And I mean, Harvard can cut off its internet access, maybe, depending. I mean, you're going to end up cutting off the people in the hallway as well. But even if they can cut off their own internet access, they can't cut out the Google access that's provided to everyone or whatever.
Right, some kind of free Wi-Fi.
And there's also cellular access, which is becoming increasingly prevalent in laptops.
Well, that is true, but I mean, that's why I would advocate for not having the laptops there,
right,
with some exceptions.
I mean, if you don't have the laptops, then...
I mean, I would just say, you know, up till 3 or 4 years ago, everyone, you know, in law school didn't have a laptop in class, or I guess like 8 years ago, whatever, laptops became common.
Yeah,
and everyone got by just fine, and you know, you do know how to write, so you could probably get the skill back. And if you took all the information from my blog, which obviously you haven't read, I said that, you know, one other problem is that transcription style notes that people take on the laptop are ineffective. And then secondly, if you had official note takers and people were using those notes, then it wouldn't be an issue like how fast you write or how detailed you are.
But you've just increased the price to the law school of having a class, and you've told me that
well,
I should have been honing a skill with you.
But somebody else did. We only got one more minute to go.
I was just going to support you a little bit. I mean, when you're practicing law or doing whatever it is you do in real life, you're probably not going to carry around a laptop and digest all the information. Maybe you will, I don't know, but it seems like most of the time when you interact with clients or with people, you kind of have to, you know, somehow digest the information you have and then, you know, retain it in some concise form. And by becoming dependent on like typing, you kind of lose that ability to extend. It's just another reason.
Yeah, I mean, in law firms, you know, everyone brings yellow legal pads.
Andrew, I guess the thing that my concern would be, something like this laptop issue has been around for a long time, but I feel like every time we talk about it, we're talking about the symptom rather than the disease. It seems like rather than banning laptops or something, why aren't we trying to look at ways to make the curriculum more engaging or to incorporate the things that the internet's good for into the teaching in terms of making the internet an integral part of the teaching process and make the classes more engaging, engage issues that seem to have more relevance to students or issues that resonate with people, or hire better teachers because...
All right, that's good. Xander.
I mean, I would just say that I think, you know, South Park is always going to be more interesting than any given class at the moment. But, you know, that said, I think South Park or another one of these TV shows is always going to be more interesting at any given moment than any class. But my point is that, you know, you're trying to make this argument that not having laptops or not having internet would be better for everyone in every case, and clearly some people disagree with you on that point. And instead of making that argument, I wonder, maybe you could say that, look, for me and for many other people, the fact that other people have laptops is a distraction, and it hampers my ability to learn, or hampers some people's ability to learn.
That's in there too. But I mean, what Andrew suggested is something I hadn't thought of. That's kind of one of the good things about this idea, is that I'd love to hear those kind of ideas and like put them on the blog too.
Along those lines, I think one thing you should look at is sort of the case method in general, because I think that a lot of the sort of issue here is that we read these cases, we spend all this time talking about these judicial opinions, and once you've read a lot of these, you kind of realize that, yeah, doctrine inconsistent, no big deal. Like, that's where I think things start to get a little boring. And if you compare it to the case method used in business school, for example, where they sort of distill things into sort of what was the decision maker at the time thinking? So what was the lawyer at the time of this case thinking? What are the sort of issues he had to deal with in coming up with an argument? If you had it that way, I think that's one way. It's one thing you should look at least, whether the case method that we currently have it this way.
And one last thing, correct me if I'm wrong, but are laptops allowed in business school classes? I don't think
no,
they are.
No.
So, I mean, there's a proven example of it working without a laptop.
I think that the issue is still the curriculum, because for me at least, once you realize that like case law is inconsistent, that we have 50 different states, that Harvard's trying to teach like this lesson to people that are going to go back to the 38 states that people of our class are from, then I completely, essentially lose interest in it. And I think to myself, I'm going to look up the case when I'm confronted with an issue, and I'm going to figure out what the law is when it's there. And once I figure out the gist of how you read cases to determine what the law is, why do I need to pay attention to you, old man?
Yeah. Like, I mean, everyone's focusing on the laptop thing. I had some other stuff.
My God.
There are other things on there aside from
laptops.
You don't use cases.
Does anyone have any comments on any of the other suggestions, like the sections or?
Yeah, I also wanted to suggest, just because I'm really passionate about this, that I think that they should do testing more than once a year, because I think that would definitely help people, like, you know, not just
finals, like,
yeah, because I think that's why people don't care. It's like they sit there and they're like, well, I don't know what he just said, and I'm going to shop online, look on an outline later. But if they did it like two or three times a year, even if it's something like multiple choice, just to, like, make sure people get concepts through, like, I think that's, I don't know,
or maybe like a midterm or something.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
I'd ask you to consider the possibility of differentiating the two spaces. That is, recognizing that there is one kind of classroom space in which laptops are closed, and there's another kind of space in which laptops are open.
So making it like an official teacher option, so that's easy for them to opt in or out?
Yes, and in the middle of class, perfectly possible for a teacher to say, close laptops or open laptops, something of that order, so that you structure the environment so that you exploit the utility of the technology, and yet don't sacrifice the benefits, tremendous benefits from having a classroom with no distractions in it.
I don't want to go too far over.
All right, so good, thank you. Who's up next? Go for it.
So our project was to, we want to design a website that, did you use your computer to?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's a hammering. Oops. So basically we're trying to design a website that teaches people the consequences of internet activity, because we think a large problem is that, not like major crimes, like not like child pornography or, you know, using credit cards on the internet, but things like downloading music or having a fan site or uploading, I guess, guitar or music lyrics. People get fined for this kind of, you know, punished for these kinds of activities, but I think the fact that the activity is so rampant kind of shows that people don't understand, I guess, the consequences of what they're doing. They either don't know how steep the fines can be, or I guess what, sometimes you can even get prison sentences for some of the activities that people do. And so it's not to say, oh, what you're doing is wrong, so much as to kind of show people, here's what the trouble that you can get into, and also sort of consequently showing the absurdity of some of the penalties that are imposed. For example,
you have to press the button a lot of times.
Did I do something wrong?
Hey, Ryan.
Yes?
See if you can give her a hand. The challenge of making law school more interesting is considerable.
One thing we don't have here, which we had at home, was things like supervisions, where you'd get kind of you'd have one academic to two to four people.
Do I
have
to put this
and
in
too?
Kind of
work.
There
we go.
Sort of.
But that really does is a really different learning experience. It really makes you think about things very differently. Because you go and you don't have a laptop. Have to read stuff.
Yeah, but you gotta understand something. It's not one size fits all.
No.
It's like Harvard Law School was built on a miserable student-faculty ratio. I mean, that was the idea. When you look at the movies, you see one professor in a large amphitheater, and we turn out lawyers at something like four times the rate of any near competitor. So we dominate the market. It's a very effective strategy. And so when thinking about what to do to fix law school, you can't lose total touch with the identity of who we are. And yet, it seems obvious that, you know, moving towards the ratio of one faculty member, two students would be a great way to go.
But that's not the ratio at all that you have at a university in the UK. You probably have, I would say, the faculty, the number of faculty is just what they have to do. And obviously you get corresponding faculty for probably less other things. And you get things like PhD students to want to supervise in some places.
But I can't see that the number of faculty is going to make any damn difference. It's the interest of what's going on rather than the number of people trying to communicate. It's like, well, all right, so how do you actually increase the interest of what's going on?
But, you know, I just find it's much more interesting being able to talk to someone rather than just hearing them lecture.
Yes, that's true.
And that's why.
But that's like minor media massage. The stuff that's genuinely interesting has got to be the content of the ideas. Whether it's delivered to you by video or face-to-face, yes, there's a certain charm quality in being in the presence of the master. Thank you very much.
I was going to say, one of the other things I was thinking about writing about was law school hiring. It seemed like places like Harvard, I could really focus on hiring these JD PhDs that have amazing research output, but maybe aren't very good at teaching. And that perhaps should have some kind of pandemic balance between teachers that are good teachers, you know, great professors from other law schools.
The biggest problem is that there's no point to law school after the first year. That you do your first year, then after that, all you're doing is just waiting to get your degree. So you have a note from Harvard promising that you're smart enough to justify being paid $160,000 a year. Like, after your first year, there's no required curriculum. The classes are entirely up to you. You can take things that matter, you can take things that don't. The law firms don't care. Nobody cares. So unless you're intellectually curious enough to really get into classes that really matter to you, most times you're just trying to punch out your 52 units so you can graduate. And so, like, the fact that the school has no point means that kids aren't going to be unengaged. And in MBA, it's a different
kind of sport. I don't agree with you at all.
No.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, I think part of the problem is this sort of misinformation of people entering law school, right? Like, what percentage of students came to law school with one conception of how law school would be like, and they got here and it was completely different? And I think that percentage is actually higher in law school than any of the other graduate schools because you don't have any kind of professional experience requirement for getting in. I think that would change a lot if you said, like, don't go straight out of undergrad, take a year, figure out whether this is really what you want to do. Also, like, the information, I mean, a lot of people come to grad school thinking it's like grad school for political science, but then the day it's not, it's learning law, and I think that has a lot to do with it too. So there's sort of the demand-driven element to it, and then there's also whatever the supply of education is, and I agree that it could be sort of bad.
Well, at some level, you've got to ask what you think the law is, and you have to have some idea about what the law is that's got a little bit more depth to it than it's a bunch of rules.
that a bunch of people try to follow. It's got larger dimension than that.
But most teachers are happy with just going over the cases, getting what you can out of them, and then moving on to the next one. That's my problem. Like, I'll go to a Common Law class, and the teacher spends the whole time just discussing what the different holdings are, like the dissent, the concurring opinion, and stuff. And I mean, if I wanted to learn that, I can spend 15 minutes reading it myself instead of spending half hour discussing it with, you know, a teacher who's really not giving you much insight besides what's written on the page.
Yeah, it's grim.
And again, I think it still has to do with the way they're testing. Like, what you test at the end is, I guess, the way that people analyze law, you know, in courts or whatever. But I think that the people, especially in law school, they try to divorce any kind of moral or, you know, subjective analysis from, you know, a ruling that a court makes, even though the professor will say, obviously, you know, the judge here is using his own personal subjective, you know, ideas to come to this ruling, but then they don't test those kinds of things at all. They just test what the judges do, which, I don't know, it seems kind of silly.
I've been working on a plan for my winter evidence class. I'm hoping to form the class into groups of eight and convene a convention of superheroes. The idea is to articulate a constitutional convention from a position of liberty and imagine the structure that we as free superheroes, under no rule, there's no government among us, coming together to consider that we'll be better off if we form a government, if we can do it in a way that doesn't sacrifice our essential liberty. That's like the articulation of the original position, and hoping that I can get the groups to assume the identities of superheroes and meet in convention and come to see how the right to jury trial and the ability to address arguments of liberty to juries is the core protection that was built into the United States Constitution and that has been drained out of it in a story that I think has a powerful narrative quality. It depends on the idea that the Constitution that was actually formed, although it was meant to be the expression of free and equal people, built into itself the flaw of slavery. And that flaw is what ultimately took down the right to jury trial as an actual bulwark of liberty. So it's, I hope it's going to be an adventure and a way of learning about the rules of evidence from the inside out. Becomes a matter of what lawyers can prove and how they can stop others from proving other stuff, basically. And I'm excited about it.
I get to pick a ring. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we get to pick out the superheroes?
The groups, yeah. They're going to have to be one of the problems with the groups.
Why superheroes?
Huh? So you're ready to go?
Oh, yeah. Oh, all right. So we actually have already purchased the domain name, donotclick.org, but it won't be active for a while.
Oh, may I just stop? Sure. I'm sorry. I meant to say something. The thing I liked best about what you had to offer us was the name. I think the name has got a real zing to it. So it's one of those where you should buy every form of that name. I know you can't do it on Facebook, but I know when I buy a domain name, that's got that problem.
Okay.
Like we bought, I don't know how many GPSDSs we bought. But the name is a really, really good name.
I'm going to email everyone the website and the Facebook report.
And the picture, I think, is pretty good. That is the general presentation of it is, I kind of like that. That's,
thanks.
All right, sorry.
So the name of our website is donotclick.org, and it should be associated with that domain name by tomorrow. So basically, the thing is, I think when people do things online, there's a disconnect between the act and the consequences of that act. For example, if you're, you know, actually going out and stealing something from a store, you know that you're stealing something, but when you're sitting in front of your computer and you're by yourself, it doesn't feel like stealing. It doesn't feel like you're doing anything that's different from just clicking on another link. And so the purpose of it is to just try to kind of show people that they are being watched and that everything that they do is trackable, and that the consequences are much steeper than they might initially think. So this isn't finished at all. this is just like the basics of it. But I guess a lot of it is focused on copyright infringement with music files and movie files and things like that. I think a lot of people don't know that the minimum fine for it is actually $750 per file. So if you download 10 songs, you pay almost $10,000 for an album that, you know, you probably would much rather pay $20 for in a store. And the funny thing is if you look at the actual laws, and this information will be up later, the fines for downloading music is actually worse than the fines for actually stealing, physically stealing something, which we find to be totally paradoxical and strange. And the main purpose is to show, I guess by showing the consequences, to prove kind of how absurd the consequences are and to kind of eventually suggest some kind of reform.
Yeah, because it seems like, I mean, most people don't have a good understanding of what piracy laws actually are, what copyright laws are. And so to that end, we also are creating a game, which we have on Scratch right now, but we'll move it maybe, I don't know, it depends on, anyways, we created this prototype of the game, which is not going to show up on, okay.
Maybe you can put it into like presentation mode.
Oh, okay. Where is that?
I think it's that little thing under the iPod.
This? Yeah. Okay. So we created a game. Like, first of all, I mean, the purpose of the game is to make it a more engaging way of, first of all, sort of showing people like what the laws are. And second of all, like what is enforced, like music downloading has been heavily enforced by the industry. In fact, this year, I think it was this month, a verdict came down from the first jury trial on illegal music downloading. A woman she downloaded like 24 songs from Kazaa, and she ended up being, had to pay the verdict was $220,000 in damages for the company, $10,000 per song. And I think most people don't have a good understanding of what's illegal, what's enforced, and so we came up with this game, which I guess, so. Yeah, so when you click on things.
But in any case, I think even more, how do you get out of this? Even more, I think, startling is something like, I don't know if you heard of Grokster, but it was one of the original file sharing websites, I guess after Napster went down. And the Supreme Court ruled that it was an illegal service, and so what they did was they got rid of their site, and now what they have up is this message, which it logs your IP. And I think a lot of people, when they first went, they were really startled because, you know that people are tracking you, but when you see it, when you see your individual computer's address up there just right before your eyes, it kind of freaks people out and maybe would discourage them from committing those activities. I guess the impetus behind doing this project was when I was working at the attorney's office, I was mostly assigned to, you know, the child porn cases. And all the defendants didn't seem to understand that just because you're doing it at home and just because you're on your computer, that doesn't make it okay, because it just doesn't feel as wrong as it would if you went and bought something, if you, you know, went and sought something out.
Because these ads pop up and you're like, oh, click on this, it's child porn, it comes up and you keep watching, but you know, in real life that would never happen.
So the internet, it makes you really passive, I think, to what you're doing, and we just think that it's important, if the laws aren't going to catch up with the way people are behaving, to at least get people caught up on what the laws are.
All right, time for comment.
What's your message?
Don't click. without knowing what you're clicking.
But what about stuff that links to stuff you didn't intend to see? Like if you click on a site, like a MySpace page, and it loads up a song on the MySpace page.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think...
I mean, I think that's the purpose of it, is that that would not be illegal. But why is that different from clicking on, you know, another link and, you know, receiving a file that's like a, you know, or even your friend sending you a song that he likes or something like that. You know, just the fact that those two activities are so similar and yet have completely different consequences, we think it's really arbitrary. And so just by kind of comparing how close those activities are and yet how different people react, the different ways in which people react to them, is that's the purpose of it, to just show, I guess, that certain acts are punished, but we don't really know why, even because they seem like the same acts. I don't know if that made sense.
So is your message actually to not click, or to kind of show the absurdity of the current copyright laws?
Well, that's kind of the point of it, is that it's both. We're trying to show people what they shouldn't click because this is what the laws are, but we're also trying to encourage laws to change
because
what really you're not allowed to click are a lot of the things that you shouldn't be clicking are kind of silly.
So that the fine for downloading was much bigger than the fine for actually stealing it from the store. Are the people who are being charged, I read this somewhere, but I'm not sure about it. Are the people being charged with downloading it or distributing it?
Both.
But, I mean, the penalties for distributing under, like, the DMCA are much higher. Like, there's jail time involved. Downloading is, like, less serious, but the fine...
It's still $7.50 per song minimum, and it can be up to $30,000 per song. If they can, I think a lot of college students have thousands of songs on their computers. That's, like, millions... I can't even do math. A lot of money, you know?
Ryan.
Okay, so you think that the copyright law ought to catch up with modern, like, common practice, right? So that's one of your points?
Yes.
Right. Should child porn law also catch up in the same way?
I don't think it should catch up. I'm not trying to advocate child porn, but I am, I guess, the reason that the whole internet thing kind of interests me, at least, is because I think that I'm not sure if child porn online is the same thing as, you know, creating it in real I'm not saying it's less wrong. I think it's still wrong, but I feel like the intent should matter, right? And I think some people, you know, when they're alone, they're in front of a computer, they don't know how much trouble they're getting into, is basically what I'm saying.
At what age should we begin to teach our children not to click?
I don't think that our purpose, I don't know. I don't want to say that we're trying to teach people not to click.
I just think that they should be aware about what the consequences are of them clicking on these things.
Yeah, but at what age should we start to counsel our children that if you click wrong, you're going to get punished?
Probably as early as possible.
As early as they start using it.
$750 and $30,000 and all. At what age does this lecture begin?
As soon as they start using the internet. Because actually, like, there was a guy that got fined because his, like, grandson, like his 7-year-old grandson, was downloading songs. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I think as soon
if
as...
If you own the computer, you're still liable, even if you didn't do
it's
the
like when you start
downloading.
When you start teaching someone
so
how
I
to drive.
So I got a grandchild coming along, I hope, and definitely going to have the little kid playing on the laptop. I better just counsel them right off the bat about all this copyright shit.
Yeah. Just
or
basic.
More realistically,
you know?
You should be aware of it so that you're able to make that decision for yourself to not teach a kid about it, just so you have the information available so that you're taking the risk on yourself.
I see.
I mean, if you think that it's absurd that you have to teach your 7-year-old child not to click on a link, then at least you know the information so that you can do something to, you know, try to change the actual law. I don't know. I feel like the message is confusing because we're not trying to say you have to teach people anything. It's more that we want the information to be more accessible and to be more obvious so that people know that there is something wrong with the way the law is right now, and also avoid penalties. I think, for example, I don't know if any of you play guitar, but it's actually illegal to put up tablature that you figured out yourself. You figure out a song, you can't put it online. Olga just got shut down. It was one of my favorite websites.
and it's, you know, it's gone. And these are things that make you wonder, like, what is going on? I don't think that the regulators know what the public opinion is about certain things. Why is that illegal? You're just sharing information that you figured out yourself. Go ahead.
What is Olga?
Olga is, I think it stands for online guitar archive. Yeah, it's basically people will listen to a song, they'll figure out how to, you know, play it, and then they'll write it down and put it online, which seems like that shouldn't be illegal, but apparently it is. So go ahead.
In terms of
oh, I was talking to him.
Sorry.
No,
I've spoken too much anyway.
Oh.
My question was just going to be, do you think that the law should be tied to, like, the cost to the to the person who holds whatever the copyright is, in terms of, like, if a 7-year-old downloads something, well, the 7-year-old wasn't going to go out and buy the movie, they downloaded it or something, so therefore there's no crime committed there. There's no loss to anyone.
Wait,
well,
what is your question?
My question was, I mean, if you're talking about do not click and stuff, is how would you, like, change the copyright law? Do you think that it should be tied in some way to the cost?
Well, I don't know. Right now, the copyright laws are focused on discouraging. Like, they're trying to price it so it discourages. They're pricing it really high because they think it's hard to catch. And so, you know, finding a price that discourages people from downloading, like the threat of, like, a $10,000 fine. I don't know. I mean,
there's a lot of ways that other countries are dealing with it. Like, in Canada, they put a tax on, you know, CD players or any kind of medium that you can use to play music and things like that, or videos or whatever, to give it back to the artist. And they also, in Canada, I think it's legal to download music, but not legal to upload music, which is also kind of confusing. So it's not like, the US, I think, has one of the strictest internet copyright infringement models.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just seems like the copyright laws are they were constructed, like, before the digital age, before networked, you know, networked information. And so I'm not sure about the exact punishments and whether or not, like, the incentives for punishment should be changed, but that the regime itself needs to be reformed in order to reflect, I mean, the weaknesses of the, you know, of information distribution and yeah.
Let's say that the internet were completely anonymous, and so there was no risk of being caught. Would you still be advocating compliance with the law, or would you be advocating civil disobedience?
I think that part of the problem is that's impossible. The internet can't be anonymous because it's computers connecting with each other, so at the very least...
Don't fight the hypothetical.
Also, there is an actual anonymous internet called Freenet. The only problem is it's really slow.
Okay, but if somebody went and, like, physically looked in that internet, you still couldn't find...
It's assuming that you trust a certain percentage of the network, like if you trust 80% of the other computers on the network to be trying to anonymize things, then cryptographically you can prove that it's anonymous to some, I mean, there are metrics for anonymity, but, like, you can basically prove the anonymity.
Okay, so assuming it's anonymous. We're not advocating that, like, artists and creators and record companies should never be compensated for, you know, the kinds of, the music and create, you know, things that they put out, but that, I mean, that the system that we have for punishing people who, you know, supposedly violate those rules should change. So,
right,
I don't know if
that
answers your question.
Advocating a stance against downloading is not necessarily completely abandoning compensation, right?
But, I mean, I think that, well,
I kind of don't understand what the anonymity has to do with it. So if you can't find out who's downloading, then I guess you can't really catch them to compensate.
Right. Compensation should not be primarily coming through lawsuits, right? The compensation for artists should be coming through lawsuits, right? I mean, even in the current landscape of fairly rampant piracy, there are still a lot of CD sales, right? So my question was just, since you think that these copyright laws are sort of ridiculous and that maybe people shouldn't be stopped from clicking on things all the time, right? Is that an adequate characterization? So if you think that, are you basically advocating not clicking on the basis of, you know, you're gonna get screwed over by the government if you click? Or are you advocating it on the grounds of there is a law that you should follow as a law-abiding citizen, regardless of the punishment. So even if you could get away with it, you should still not do it, but you should hate the law too.
Both.
I don't think you can have it both ways. I think it was a very well put question.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think the latter. I don't know what.
Okay, definitely the latter. I thought it could be both. Because
well,
wrong.
I mean, I do think.
Which one? That articulate the latter for us.
Well,
that, you know, here's the law and you should follow it because you're a law-abiding citizen, but we think that the law itself should change. It's but not even that. I feel like there's a lot of moral.
See, this is a very serious question. This is, imagine you're back in the convention of superheroes. Here we are. We are assembled in convention here. We have complete freedom to go anywhere on the net, do anything we want. And we're about to agree to a government. How do we feel about the idea that this new world is going to have a bunch of rules that are going to tell us that we can't click on things?
I think the point is more that I don't know if it's that you should not download things that don't belong to you. I don't think that's what we're trying to say. It's more that the reality is that if you do, you might get screwed by the government.
Yes, but that's exactly what Ryan's saying.
Right.
That is, all right, there's a rule structure that's articulated and it's got a stick in back of it, and somebody's being told it's wrong morally to violate this rule, but it's just a rule that somebody made.
Right.
And we're wondering, where are you? Are you on the moral side of saying, hey, there's a freedom to click on anything I want on this net? Or are you on the moral side of saying, no, somehow that freedom should be taken away and
no.
sacrificed to this incentivizing of creativity that supposedly justifies the copyright law?
It's a hell of a loaded question.
Yes.
Sacrifice
yeah.
freedom. Nicely done, Captain Advocate.
Well,
oh, well.
I
you got me.
You're not very fair.
See, I think it's the second. We have different views on this. I think it's the second. Because I honestly do believe that, you know, while there is a... I mean, I believe that, you know... I think that what I would want to do with this is that... is to say that people should know the law and should follow it, but knowing that law, be able to change it, to some extent to advocate for greater freedom of information and communication.
But why should people follow the law?
I mean, I think this is just for their protection, because their ignorance right now is costing them, you know.
Oh, just but for purely instrumental reasons. You should
yeah.
follow
right,
the law
right.
because otherwise you get hurt.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I
not
think
because there's any moral valence to it whatsoever.
Well, I mean, I think that there is moral valence to it, but I think that where people are getting
what's the moral valence to it?
I mean, I think that
this is where we disagree.
Well, no, I mean, I think that the moral part of this is that I think that the laws are not in sync with. I mean, I do believe in protecting, you know, information and protecting, like, someone's creation, but I think that the law needs to change in order to reflect the way that... I mean, I just don't think that record companies can enforce the law the way that they've been doing it, because it's outdated, but I do believe that they have a right to protect their you know, their property.
Where's the difference?
So, if a person writes a song, obviously they should have the right to sell it and not have somebody steal it and say, I wrote the song, and then try to make money off of it, something like that. You know, otherwise people won't create things, and that would really, you know, our lives would be worse off. But I think on the internet, file sharing, I don't know, I have a hard time seeing that as something that's morally wrong. I mean, for me it's the same thing as checking out a book in the library, listening to something on the radio. It feels just like, I mean, even if you go to two different websites and click on two different links, on one link you're downloading a television show from BitTorrent, that's free and illegal. On one link you're watching it on NBC.com, that's free and legal, and I just don't see the difference. Also, if you look at the actual statistics, I mean, the most recent study, I think, from Harvard, the public policy school or something like that, was like 0.07% of
music sales have declined as a result of illegal downloads. So I just have a hard time really seeing, you know, the moral argument of why you can't download a song online.
Thank you very much, but I, my advice to you on your project would be to project this difference, figure out this difference, not to resolve it, but to etch it as sharply as you could. That's the real, that's a wonderful question.
Okay, thanks.
All right, good.
All right, who's up?
And this game has promise. It's very engaging when you see the face, but I don't know where it goes from there. But it's definitely something that catches your interest and you say,
well, it's,
oh, good.
It's on the Scratch website, so you can play with the version that's on there now. It's under my, I think it's in Cyber One, but it's under my RH link.
Uh-huh.
Does anyone know the current law? If you TiVo an episode and then rip it off of your DVR onto your computer, is that illegal?
I would think so, yeah.
That seems really stupid.
Well, I think, no, wait, did you say it? I think it is legal because you can rip it and you can keep it on your own computer. In that, there was a case like Universal Studios on that issue on with VCRs, like whether or not you can tape something. So, I mean, I think that this has not been decided yet, but...
And that whole, that's a whole question of time shifting, but I mean, I don't know about shifting from TiVo to the laptop itself.
Isn't that what a Slingbox does?
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know, but I mean, is that, do they get around it, are they licensed? Is it a license deal of some sort, or?
I think you can do it.
It's like, I don't see a, I don't even know if the law speaks this, but like, at what point does it become illegal?
I think that's a breach of your contract with TiVo, actually. And you probably have to violate the DMCA in order to open up your TiVo and do that. But
okay, then what about a TV capture card?
I don't think that's illegal. If you're time shifting, right, it's the same as a VCR, right?
Exactly, but like at some point it's got to become illegal for me to have, like if I edit the commercials out, is it still legal for me to own that? Or
yeah,
okay.
It's time space and shifting then, under Betamax, right?
Yeah.
Under Sony.
That was addressed when they said, him saying somebody could sit at the VCR.
Okay, so is it legal if I record something on a VHS tape and then give it to a friend?
I don't think that's.
Okay, so the point where you give it to somebody else who didn't do the work themselves to record it is where it becomes illegal?
I think
even if I don't maintain an original copy myself. Like,
I mean,
the baloney gets sliced thinner.
Yeah. Because, I mean, at some point, it's got to go from just storing a file on my computer to becoming illegal. And is that when I give it to somebody else, let them download, while maintaining a copy myself, or if I just destroy my own copy and let somebody else hold it, isn't that just like the same thing as giving them a tape?
Yeah, I mean, if you buy a CD, you can certainly sell it, right? The doctrine of first sale. Have you bought the show when you watched it on your
like
TV?
If I invested my time.
Ads?
Yeah.
No idea.
Onward and upward.
So my project is about nuclear terrorism, and specifically, I've done a lot of work on this issue, and one of the things that I've noticed along those lines is that the current structure of our government is inadequate to deal with this threat. And so basically my idea is to, Congress has recognized this, and in August of 2007, they passed a law, and the President signed a law, the 9/11 Commission Act. And as part of that act, they created a position, a White House level senior position called the U.S. Coordinator for Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. And the idea here was, currently in our government, we have a completely sort of decentralized approach to attacking nuclear terrorism. You've got programs across all these different agencies. There's no sort of centralized authority overseeing them. There's no ultimate accountability. And this law, part of this law is to create this office that would play that role. I worked in the State Department over the summer, and it became pretty clear that there was sort of resistance within the bureaucracy for this. They basically don't want another boss to answer to. And so I think for the most part, the administration has sort of dragged its feet, and it hasn't appointed anyone to this position, even though it's legally obliged to do so. So what I want to do is create this sort of grassroots campaign to increase, A, I think just this hasn't been in the news, so there's not much public profile, so I want to increase the public profile of this issue, and B, get enough people to write letters to their congressman, write letters to the editor, and do things that this becomes an issue that the president actually goes ahead and appoints someone. And so this is a website that I started in order to do that, and it's stopnuclearterror.org. The idea is that right now it's focused on this particular campaign, but over the longer term, I think it will have, you know, other issues and things that come up related to nuclear terror, so I want to go more broad with it. I put together a few slides that go into the argument of things. So we know through U.S. intelligence that Al-Qaeda is actively seeking a nuclear capability. They've tried to purchase one materials from a Sudanese group for $1.5 million. Turned out they got sort of fake uranium. Bin Laden has met with Pakistani scientists. They negotiated with Chechenian rebels. We found bomb designs in a safe house in Afghanistan. And a radical cleric in May 2003 issued a fatwa justifying terrorist use of weapons of mass destruction. So the takeaway from that is they intend to use nuclear weapons if they can get them. The sad part is the sort of state of security right now around Russian facilities is such that they're actually vulnerable to theft. If you look at these numbers, the percent of facilities that are vulnerable is just astronomically high, and this is a real problem. We've obviously tried to do a lot to improve this. I mean, the situation has improved, but it hasn't enough, and the reason for that is it's just a lack of urgency on the part of the Russians and not enough priority given to it in our own government. Once a terrorist group acquires the material, and there's a common myth that, you know, it's too complicated to build a nuclear bomb, they wouldn't be able to do it, but in actuality, it wouldn't take that much. About $10 million, 19 people in 6 months, they could build a nuclear bomb. And so if you compare that to the sort of coordination that had to go into the 9/11 acts, it's pretty clear that they probably would be capable of doing something like it if they were to get the nuclear material. If it did happen, the death toll would dwarf anything we've ever seen. A nuclear bomb that was detonated in Manhattan in Grand Central Station during a workday would kill about 500,000 people, cause about $1 trillion of economic damage. So this is a big deal. This map just shows what the blast radius would be. So this is New York City. The red circle there, that's basically Times Square, a bunch of other areas. It's a third of a mile in radius. Within that area, you'd have 100% fatality rate. All buildings would be completely vaporized. Within the green circle, you'd have damage to buildings that's like the Oklahoma City bombings. Within the blue circle, you just sort of have fires all over the place. So it would wipe off these landmarks off the map. So the current structure, basically you've got all these agencies with sort of sub-agencies that deal with nuclear terrorism in some way. They all report to their own agency heads. There's no central authority that's actually coordinating things. And so the result, you've got this map, which is, this is all the programs in our government that deal with nuclear terrorism in some way. You see that there's a lot of duplication. So on the bottom, there's sort of the different stages of the nuclear terrorism process they're addressing. And then each of the little boxes is a separate program. You see it's across four different agencies. It's kind of a mess. And so because of this, we've had a lot of sort of issues. There's a failure to act. Example of this is that the Department of Energy has this program where they can sort of take surveys of cities in terms of the radiation levels, and this would be really useful in the aftermath of a nuclear attack in terms of trying to figure out when you have to evacuate people, where you have to evacuate them. They've got the capability. They spent money to build it, but now they don't have the funding to actually get the cities to go ahead and do it. DHS has funding, but they don't have the sort of capacity to inform cities. So basically, we have this program that's going underused. Similar things have happened in other agencies where you get a lot of duplicative costs and administration costs. DOE spends 25% of its money on threat reduction on administration. And then DOD and DOE have totally different policies in terms of securing nuclear weapons facilities in Russia. They don't share best practices and lessons learned, so it's kind of a mess. If you had a central person dealing with this, there would be a lot of sort of advantages. It would be a clearer reporting structure, more accountability, a lot easier to coordinate things, clear channels for communication in a crisis. So basically, there's a lot of benefits if you could actually get this centralized. Congress recognized it, they created the position. And he would also be responsible for sort of creating a grand strategy, not just nuclear terrorism, but also accounting for things like proliferation and things like that. So that's sort of the argument. And I sort of tried to scope the nuclear terrorism is such a big issue. I wanted to scope this in a very specific way. So I think this, you know, putting pressure on the president to appoint someone to a position that's already been created illegally seems like an achievable outcome. And so the website basically lays out sort of an action plan for how we might do this. The first element, I created a Facebook group. The idea is this is how you generate traffic, get people who are interested in the topic to sort of get together and maybe get them to come to the website. So in just a day, we've gotten over 25 members, and they've invited, I invited, I think, 100 people, and now there's about 600 people who've been invited. So people, it seems like it's starting to grow. The other thing we recommend is writing letters to elected officials or letters to editor. And what we do on the website is actually provide, you know, a step-by-step process for how they can do this and a sample letter that they can use. So that's basically the idea.
All right, open for comment.
Is it personal? You probably mentioned this, but are they appointed by the president, or?
Yeah.
Do you think that, do you think that's an issue? Like that it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, the executive branch kind of.
In other words, do you think it's a good idea?
Yeah. Do you think it's a good idea to have it be an appointee of the executive branch, or, you know, maybe?
Yeah, I do think it's a good idea, because basically this guy would be sort of almost sort of similar to what we have now for the domestic terrorism, almost a cabinet-level position without having control over a department. But I think it's important for it to be appointed by the president, because he's basically going to be working with the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. There's a lot of sort of, you know, he's going to have to reach into a lot of different agencies, so it would make sense for it to be appointed by the president.
Just going to follow on. I mean, one of the challenges that's come out of the Homeland Security, I think, is kind of like, you know, an executive-appointed group that it's obviously a little bit different, but, you know, they've kind of, in some instances, abused their power under the Patriot Act, according to some people's point of view. And it seems like this would open up, this type of position would be open to the same kinds of abuses.
Basically creating the position isn't actually creating any additional sort of, you know, it's not like, not quite like the Patriot Act, where it's empowering this guy to do anything that's not already been done. His job is simply to sort of look at everything that's already being done in government and figuring out where are we doing it the right way, where's the duplication, how can we fix that, how can we run things more efficiently, do we have a clear sort of reporting structure, are people accountable? Because what's happening right now, if you talk to people, like experts on the field, the issue is that, you know, unlike, say, Iran or North Korea, where, like, there's new developments every day in the news cycle, people responding to them, this issue is kind of in the back burner. Sort of things that happen in the shadows. So if I'm an overstretched official in Washington, this thing's at the bottom of my inbox. And unless there's someone there to say, listen, you're responsible for this, I need this done by this date, it just doesn't get done. Andrew?
Wasn't that what the director of National Intelligence, the National Intelligence Director, whatever that new position was, the cabinet-level position that they... Isn't this essentially the sort of thing that they're supposed to do?
They're responsible for the intelligence side of things, which is just broader. This is more of a specific role, and we're just looking at WMD and just looking at proliferation.
So then, I mean, at least, would it make sense in terms of just like, I guess, logistical organization to have just like the director of national intelligence, like a deputy director for weapons, you know, WMD proliferation,
right,
or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, this guy is basically serving, I mean, it's not creating like a whole, I mean, it sort of would be a small office, and it would, I mean, it's effectively probably somewhat around that. I mean, he'd be working closely with the DNI, I'm sure. But it's basically just like kind of a senior level. Basically, the idea is like you want this guy to have a presidential mandate, so when he goes into the agencies and tries to get things done, he's acting under the sort of the authority of the president, and that's how he can get things done and drive action through the bureaucracy.
Who put this bill through Congress?
It was a pretty big bipartisan bill. Basically, the idea was like, well, after the 9/11 commission.
But who pushed it through?
I'm not exactly sure. I think it was. I actually don't know. Basically,
why do you suppose all the agencies are resisting it?
The agencies as a whole like the bill. This particular provision, they don't particularly like, at least at state. I don't know about the other agencies.
Well, why do you think they don't like this provision?
Because they think it's going to sort of add another layer of people. They say there's another person they've got to report to. They don't want to have to deal with that. And they sort of, I think, are afraid of sort of ceding some of the authority that they have over particular programs. And I think that there are sort of, at times, just interagency cooperation doesn't work very well, and adding something like this is going to force more of it.
Do you actually care about this?
Yeah.
Why?
Because, I mean, I think it's a pretty... I mean, the last thing I'd want is the day after a nuclear attack to say, well, we should have done this. I mean, there's no reason not to structure our government in a way that'd be the most effective to deal with the threat now if we can't. I mean,
how much is it going to cost?
It probably won't cost a lot. I mean, it'll be the salaries of the director and the deputy director and the staff. I don't know. I mean, it's already been passed and allocated for. I mean, it's just the cost aspect of it has already been baked in. All I'm saying is the president should appoint someone. He hasn't appointed anyone, and he should.
This is kind of just a point about the way in which the argument is made. I'm not sure whether it does resonate with people. A lot of times when you get told that there's a kind of, particularly with weapon mass destruction threat, you get told this, you know, it's going to happen, it's very easy. Some people turn off straight away because they just think, I simply don't believe that anymore.
Right.
The other point is that this is actually quite a benign thing potentially to actually do to counter it. So maybe just with the argument not to overly go for the, it's really going to happen, it's, you know, it's a matter of time, ticking bomb.
Right.
Just because I think that puts off some people who would otherwise very much be in support.
Right. Yeah, no, I think the PowerPoint sort of focuses more on that aspect, but the website doesn't really talk about much about the how likely it is. It's more, listen, this is a threat. If it happens, it'll be terrible. This is a pretty easy way to at least prepare our government for that eventuality. I mean,
all right, thanks very much.
Sure.
Now, as far as I can tell, we haven't got time to do the next one.
Do it quickly, I guess.
We can go over by that time.
Huh?
We can go over by that time.
Go over?
Your
people suggested that we go over?
He can say.
In the spirit of unpopular
history. How many other people are there? So, four?
Five?
Six?
Six? Go like mad tomorrow. But I think that's what we should do. I don't think I should keep you up. In which event, class dismissed.
And
did you
have the
equal
plus list
at all? Okay. Does anyone know, does that Facebook group link work to anyone?
Yeah. And I couldn't see it before, so.
Okay.
So if we
have
a full class list, how
am I going to
figure out?
If we did have a good class list, people would all have to email me, like, I saw what you know, and like two people emailed me, and there was massive resistance to that.
I figured that I was getting the emails that you would figure it out.
Critique somebody else's project as your final project is turning your own project into a 5-page
project.
How did you
build the website? No, so I built it in like Microsoft.
Might be like 1,000.
I'm going to show
for you.
No, I was listening to it.
in terms of
assemblies that are hosted for you?
Yeah, so if you, they hosted for free to you, if you don't mind having this slot. So yeah, it's basically like $7 to buy the company. So it's not bad.
Yeah, that looks fine. Yeah. But I feel bad. I checked my domain name. I'm not going to check it. You don't mind? Yeah. I like raised the price.
Oh, really? That didn't happen to me because I checked it a couple times. I was like, I don't know if I really want to buy it. But I couldn't figure out enough way to get it.
I think it's like,
I don't agree with you. I mean, well, like, I only wanted to hear with you that I could hear with my screening.
It's not playing tickets. If you ever go out to the airline website and ask for a lot, you buy it and come back to
us. So you like that?
No, I don't want to get on the
I mean, you can't be a rebel if you're going to be a poor student who has to pay like
$100,000.
But they were asking questions purely on copyright infringement. The point isn't like music or whatever. It's completely
My point is that it doesn't matter what you're doing. Talking to like an audience, it doesn't matter what you want to
say. You know, just people argue to not be their lawyer.
I'm just saying.
My point is that whatever you pick to talk about, you want to talk about, there's an element that your audience didn't want to hear. It's older than they wanted to hear, and they are going to be on that.
I know. That's why I'm annoyed.
Well, that's a problem.
But because you said it, now you're going to hear it.
No, that's a problem with
us. I just said it 10 minutes ago.
That's an issue as a presenter that you have to structure your argument.
You should have done a PowerPoint presentation.
That's probably true. I'm trying
to understand the picture.
Everyone likes Mons because there's a generic picture of Mons.
But I thought, I didn't realize we had to be done with our project. It'll be a picture of somebody breaking into a store and a picture of someone with their hand on their mouse and an equal sign in between.
But again, I don't even get your guys' message. You have to tell people, you have to let people know what the law is so they don't get themselves in trouble.
You have to, but we're hoping that by showing people, it will encourage people to change the law. And actually, there are suggestions for how to do so, one of which is a little radical, but
there are so many technical problems for me.
It's true that, like,
once those get started,
it's
very interesting.
So if you,
there's something to do. I don't think that they know the law in any way. That's what change happens. A lot of people know the law.
It's a very similar issue too. So many people do it that people don't even realize how bad.
I think you
can definitely go at it from the racial standpoint.
All statistics indicate that if you put to a referendum, the laws would change. Yeah, when put to a referendum, they defeat itself.
But that's because if you come at it from like everyone should be able to do what they want, no one's going to sympathize with you.
So,
but if you come at it from like, this is basically used to target like young black men and put them in jail.
Still not going to sympathize.
That's not true.
A lot of people with money aren't going to sympathize with that because we want the cops to be able to.
But more people with sympathize with that than the first.
Yeah, you're right. But absolutely.
That message is not an obvious one.
Marijuana laws are just used to profile cops.
I
think the rules.
I feel like what's going to happen is people
smoke a lot of weed. And they'll do one of the low in like their 30s or whatever, or 40s, and they're a kid. They equate the time when they used to smoke a lot of weed with when they were irresponsible.
What about alcohol?
But people continue to drink. Most people continue to smoke pot.
That's not true. I think just many people. taper off and drinking a
Because people still drink casually, might have a glass of wine.
And you think people casually smoke pot?
Or even like they pass an average, you're probably talking about 20 to 30% of the country. How many people do you think? Is your argument that similar percentages of people casually smoke weed as often as they casually drink?
Yes.
You think that an equal number of people are smoking a joint, or a similar number of people are smoking a joint as are drinking a glass of wine?
Pretty similar.
You could not make it more.
So maybe a letter should focus to, I guess,
on the push.
Imagine how much
weed. Although I did think that this could be an easy way.
If the number of people in America who drink a glass of wine or have a beer